Chicago Bears running back turned actor Thomas Jones. Author and journalist Eric Schlosser, and another installment of The Swap Meet with Greg Clamp. Now here's your host, a man who is thinking about crock-potting a goat, Justin Kaufman.
Everyone's butchering goats, you know, letting goats run wild in their restaurants. Why don't we slow cook a goat? Right? Be ready by tomorrow game time. Good evening, everybody. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. The rains look to subside a little bit. Well, we got a great show to keep you companion tonight. Thomas Jones is going to be joining us a little bit later. The Chicago Bears running back, Super Bowl 2006-2007 season. We'll talk with him about we'll talk about football and we'll talk about his memories of that Bears team, but we'll talk about his transition to being an actor. Thomas Jones is now Thomas Q. Jones, and he is starring in the new show Luke Cage on Netflix. So we're going to talk with Thomas Jones. How cool is that? I hope he doesn't rip my head off if I mention Cedric Benson, right? Anyway, looking forward to that. That's going to be awesome. Also, I'm really excited to talk with Eric Schlosser tonight. He's the man who is behind he wrote the book Fast Food Nation, also Reefer Madness. He's also, his book Command and Control has been turned into a documentary, which he helped produce and co-write for American Experience. It's going to be at the Siskel Center this Friday, and it goes for a week. We're going to talk with him. He's going to be my guest at the big table. One of the best authors and investigative reporters. I mean, he has done so much. Fast Food Nation was all about sanitary conditions. It was really, people say it was almost like the jungle, Upton Sinclair's book for now, you know, it's present day. His book Reefer Madness, looking at the way that migrant workers are used, both with marijuana and the porn industry. There was a tremendous, all these turned into movies, by the way. And Command and Control is about nuclear wars or nuclear warheads and how safe they are. It really focuses on an accident in 1980 in Arkansas. We're going to talk about it. It's going to be great. I'm so excited to talk to him. How great is it to have Eric Schlosser in the studio at the big table? Can't get any better than that. We'll talk with artists and members of the Elmhurst Art Museum tonight. We're going to talk about their new exhibit, Blow Up. It's about inflatable art. I went and saw this exhibit, Pete. Loved it. It's essentially, just as it said, it is Blow Up. It's like the Macy's Day Parade in an art museum. No Snoopy, no Stewie. It's a real artist doing great things with inflatables. So we'll talk about that. And also tonight, Greg Flam, back with Swap Meet, Adam Hoge. And talk about the Bears and the injury report, which is bananas. There are 15 people on that report. Hey. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier. He's got the hurricane updates all night long. Traffic with Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. Come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's get this show on the road, shall we? Let's start with the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The Southeast is bracing for Hurricane Matthew. They're expecting 140-mile-per-hour winds for the storm as it heads north through Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina tomorrow through the weekend. This will be the first time a hurricane Category 3 or higher has hit the U.S. since Hurricane Wilma in 2005. Governors are pleading with residents to evacuate, so if you can make it up to Chicago, you can stay with us for a bit. I mean, they're turning the Trib Tower into condos, so it would work out for you. Closer to home, no move on the Chicago Teachers Union and Chicago Public Schools contract negotiations, although protesters for charter schools are angry because I guess limiting charter schools is part of the negotiations. Okay, then. I really hope the teachers don't strike because there are too many charter schools. I mean, it seems like something you should be mad about, but you probably should still go to work, right? Right. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan's actually holding his nose and campaigning with Donald Trump this Saturday. $20 says that Trump insults him while introducing him. When I think Donald and Paul, I think Biff and George McFly. The early years. McFly! Snap Incorporated, formerly known as Snapchat, is looking for public valuation. It looks like the social media company wants to start at $25 billion. But they are Snapchats, so they don't get to keep the money. It goes away after like a minute. But all the cute doggy faces. So cute. A new study says that human beings have reached our lifespan limit. We can't get any older. 125, that's the cap, and it's pretty much out of the question. What? Man, I'm 42 and my back hurts. 125? No thanks. No. Shoot me now. Chicago Alderman Brendan Riley wants to take away Donald Trump's honorary street sign here in Chicago, which begs the question, why did we give him a street sign in the first place? Because he built a building? I thought if you got an honorary street sign, you had to be an alderman, a commissioner, a columnist, or a streets and sand worker, right? I mean, if you're going to take it away, I say just give it to Garrett's Popcorn. Hey, cool. Meet me over at Garrett Popcorn Street. In weather, rainy. Of course, Hurricane Matthew is hitting ground in Florida. Not good. Disney even shut down today at noon. I mean, they had to. Have you ever smelled a wet mouse? Ugh, gross. In sports, the Cubs are preparing for the San Francisco hippies with their long hairs and their sculpted facial hair to come to Wrigley Field on Friday. Madison Bumgarner was great last night finishing off the Mets, which was actually great for Cubs fans. I love watching the Mets lose. Now it's time for the Demons of 1989 to pack their bags. Traffic is going to be a mess around Wrigley. Probably not going to rain. Security's going to be tight. It's playoff baseball, baby. The Cubs win. Let's flip some cars. Sound good? Good. Good news. Vegas gives the Cubs the best odds to win the World Series. So enjoy that info, Cub fans. No need for the anxiety, right? Right. In playoff baseball today, Toronto kicked the crap out of the Rangers in Game 1. And Boston and Cleveland just got underway. The Bears got some good injury news. Linebacker Danny Trevathan's progressing faster than expected and may play on Sunday with a cast on his hand to protect his broken thumb. Although the news is, of course, offset by the fact that Eddie Royal sat out practice today, along with 14 others on the injury list, including four or five players that played last week. So, Bears, one good, everything else so bad. I mean, they can't even win in practice. In college football, the Cats get a bye. Come on, Cats, you can win this week. Northwestern looked good in an upset against Iowa on Saturday, so it's kind of a tough week for a bye. You'd like to see some momentum. Lovie and the Illini got their butt kicked by Nebraska last week, and they have Purdue this week. Bulls basketball, pretty nice that we don't have to pay attention to Derrick Rose like they do in New York, huh? That alone was a good reason to move him, I think. And Joakim Noah, he's already making negative headlines for refusing to eat with West Point cadets because he hates war or something like that. Again, dodged a bullet. Today's the anniversary of Jordan's first retirement in 1993. Ah, so that's why it's raining. Bulls play Pacers tonight. And finally, it turns out that the Kardashian clan have canceled their trip to Chicago this weekend. Kanye West is performing at the United Center, and they were going to shoot their reality series in and around town. But after the events in Paris, Kardashians, they're just not coming. Darn it. I guess I could stop working on my crocheted Kourtney and Kim sweatshirt that I was making. I'll save it to next time. That's the carryout for October 6, 2016. In honor of the Cubs game tomorrow night, we are doing Fly the W Euros. More to come on the download tonight. Coming up, Adam Hoge. We should have Adam read the injury report, like a dramatic interpretation of the 15 names of the Chicago Bears that are on the injury report. Talk with Adam, and also Eric Schlosser will be in studio at the big table. It's a download at 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, 630, says, what about the SI curse? The SI curse has doomed the Cubs the last three times. Why did they keep doing this to us? What city is Sports Illustrated based in? I think they knew exactly what they were doing. A lot of anxiety going on right now.
Oh, that New York elite media again. Man, yeah, I hate those guys.
You know what we should do? We should just, you know, if they're going to play this game, if SI is going to do this, you know what? Have fun. I hope you get a ton of sales at the thing, but you're not getting any press from us.
For the diehard Cubs fans out there, and one especially sitting in the producer's booth tonight, one Mr. Pete Zimmerman, here's the deal. I honestly think that they're over it. Because I can't remember who he was shilling for, but Chris Bryant was actually in a pose with a bat in a batting cage with the goat in front of him.
That is a great commercial.
And he had a great season. It was, you know, he had a great season.
It was Adidas.
Was that what it was? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and it was I just saw it the other night. Yeah. And I was like, wow, look at that. And it's like all the main athletes in America right now, from James Harden and on the Rockets.
Right. That's it. Yeah.
All
yeah,
the
yeah.
different great players, and Chris Bryant's in that commercial. You're like, man.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Didn't affect his season.
Yeah, right.
Goat what?
Oh, I love it. That song again. That song really pumps you up when the Bears are... when the Bears are... it gets faded out. Let's talk a little Bears. Obviously, they have a game on Sunday against the Indianapolis Colts, but I'm not sure they're going to have enough players to actually play that game. Joining us on the line, Adam Hoge, WGN Radio Sports covers the Bears. You can check it out at WGNradio.com/Bears, where his podcast is also up. I believe the new one is up now, Intentional Grounding. Adam Hoge, how are you, my man?
I'm good, Justin. Yeah, it is up, and we brought in a doctor today to talk about Kevin White and some of these injuries, because that's kind of at the point we're at with all this, all the injuries the Bears are dealing with right now.
John Fox today, his audio of reading the injury list and how more despondent and depressed he got as the list went on was so telling. The Chicago Bears, I mean, you could say what you will about playing a violent sport like football, but this is egregious, the idea that 15 Bears are on the injury list.
Yeah, 30% of the roster on the injury report, and a lot of guys not practicing. The good news today was that Zach Miller went from not practicing yesterday to being limited with what they're calling a ribs injury. But, yeah, things have gotten worse because they've lost Kevin White now for at least 8 weeks. Good chance he's gone for the season if he can't get back from this this new fracture in his fibula. Same leg as last year, which he had the fracture in his tibia. And so he's gone now. Eddie Royal's dealing with a calf. Eddie Royal's been one of the bright spots so far in the season. And so those are two big losses to your group of wide receivers if Eddie can't play this weekend, which is still, I'm not convinced Eddie's going to be out, but that would be a loss because he certainly seems to look more like the young guy we saw in Denver that was running around catching all those passes with Jay Cutler back in the day.
Yeah, he's definitely been one of the bright spots for the Chicago Bears. I mean, how do the Bears deal with this kind of adversity? I mean, to have this many players, first off, I guess I should ask, are these real injuries, or is this sort of a byproduct of the new way the NFL does injury reports, where everybody's either questionable or ready? They got rid of, what was it, probable, things of that nature. Are we seeing a lot of players that do have nagging injuries who probably will play on Sunday?
Well, the way the injury reports work, and what you just brought up was a change that they did make this year where they got rid of probable. That really only affects what we see on Fridays, because on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, they give us practice statuses, which is their normal amount of reps in practice. Because of some kind of lingering injury, must be listed on that injury report. And the way the NFL keeps you accountable for that is they can ask you for any practice tape, and you have to cough it up and show it to them. So I don't know how often they actually review that, but that is the way to keep them accountable to that. And then on Fridays, they also give you what's called the game status, and that's where they list the players on the injury report as either out, doubtful, or passed, or was also probable. And the NFL just got rid of that for whatever reason. They say it's for clarity, but I think it adds more doubt, because anybody who used to be probable is probably now being listed as questionable.
Right.
Makes it more of a question. To answer your original question about whether or not there's more guys on here just because of the new way the injury report's done, I don't think so. I think it's just a matter of a lot of guys dealing with nagging injuries right now who aren't practicing as much as they normally would, and the Bears are required to put them on the injury report.
Now, some bright spots. I mean, Danny Trevathan has been practicing, even though he's going to have a cast on his hand for his broken thumb or his fractured thumb. That's a good sign for the Chicago Bears, that some of the guys who were injured earlier in the year seem to be making strides to get back on the field.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of a silver lining here if you want to look for it. And I wrote this yesterday in my 10 Bears things on WGNradio.com. Most of these key, really just go position by position, the amount of injuries the Bears have in the key spots, it's unbelievable. It'd be hard for any team to overcome that, except maybe you look at the Minnesota Vikings right now, which are without their quarterback, their Hall of Fame left tackle at this point on offense and seem to be doing. You know, the Bears are down their number one quarterback, their number one running back in Jeremy Langford, their number two wide receiver now in Kevin White. You go to the defense, they're without their number one nose tackle in Eddie Goldman. They're without Danny Trevathan, their inside linebacker, rusher in Pernell McPhee, who you kind of forget about at this point.
Yeah.
Their number two corner in Kyle Fuller. And there's a long list of these guys. They also go, you go back to training camp, they lost their center, their number one center, Hronis Grassou, for the year. That's the exception there, Grassou. For the most part, otherwise, technically, all these guys could come back at some point this season, except the Bears must choose between Kevin White and Kyle Fuller because they're on injured reserve and you can only bring one guy back from reserve. Yeah, you can only bring one guy back. It used to be zero. And then a couple of years ago, they said, okay, well, you can designate one player to return at the beginning of the season. Now they say you don't have to designate anybody to return. You can bring back one person at any point, but you're only allowed one.
If you were a betting man, who do you think has a better chance of seeing the field this year?
Well, they're going to – first of all, Kyle Fuller's healthier. Okay, Kyle Fuller probably could have gotten back on the field maybe even by this week or next week. The Bears got into a tough spot with how many injuries they had that they had to release somebody to bring – either release somebody or put someone on injured reserve to fill in the roster spots, okay? And the way Kyle Fuller's knee was still acting up, they decided to just put him on IR with the idea that they could bring him back. Now, for the long term and what's best for the Bears, if Kevin White – is able to return later this season, if they deem that as something that is possible, they're going to bring Kevin White back over Kyle Fuller any day of the week because these guys didn't draft Kyle Fuller. They're both former first-round draft picks, yeah. But Kevin White's their guy. Kyle Fuller's not. And they found some depth here at corner. I mean, another bright spot has been Bryce Callahan.
He played great the other night. Yeah, the other day.
He played outstanding the other day. They have DeAndre Hall. They have Jacoby Glenn. They have Cravon LeBlanc, who they got from the Patriots, a rookie there. There's four guys here, and still Tracy Porter is their number one corner. So they're struggling to find playing time for all these young kids right now. So Kyle Fuller is not really a priority, even though he's probably the healthier option. So to answer your question, Justin, if Kevin White's able to come back, they're going to bring Kevin White back. If he's not, then that's where they'll bring Kyle Fuller back.
Adam Hogue on the line with us. Adam Hogue, of course, covers the Chicago Bears for WGN Radio. You can find it at WGNradio.com/Bears. All right, let's talk about the opponent this week, the Indianapolis Colts. They also are 1-3. But in those games, even that game against Jacksonville in London last week, a game against Detroit earlier in the season, they're one of these teams that, yes, they have a terrible record, but they've lost these games in the last second.
Yep. That's true. They've been close games, and the Colts have a lot of talent on the roster. They also have a lot of turmoil. You really go back to the last calendar year, and I think there's severe questions about how much friction there is in that organization, how much maybe the players are bought in right now to this current regime. Many thought that Ryan Grigson, the general manager, and or the head coach, Chuck Pagano, was going to be let go at the end of last season. Instead, the Colts kind of shocked everybody by extending them both. But getting off to a 1-3 start here hasn't really alleviated those questions that were still persisting last year when the Colts went 8-8. So I look at this, and I'm not really, you know, dialed into the Colts like I am the Bears, obviously, but I really kind of think this is a huge game for Indianapolis because, to me, just looking at this from the outside, it's the type of situation that could spiral out of control quickly if they lose a home game to the 1-3 Chicago Bears. And that's where you could certainly start to lose a locker room if you haven't already. So I think that's a big question mark going into this game, and it's going to really be a huge factor in who wins this game on Sunday as well.
All right, so I mean, the Bears got one of the Colts' heart and soul. You know, one of their leaders, Darrell Freeman, came over in free agency.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. I mean, the Colts. You know, you mentioned it in your article, just the concept that the Colts and Coach Pagano, they weren't happy about losing Darrell Freeman. Does he at all have a chip on his shoulder? Is he going to play lights out to try and beat the team that essentially let him go?
Well, yeah. I mean, Darrell is downplaying that idea, but look, it's human nature to to look at that and say, yeah, he's going to have a little bit extra juice in this game. Now, I did a radio show in Indianapolis earlier today. First of all, they're really upset about losing Jarrell Freeman down there. They have not been able to fill the void. They don't really understand it. They're being very critical of the organization for losing Jarrell Freeman, especially with how well he's played for the Bears so far, and that's all fair. I guess what they explained to me was that the Colts offered Jarrell a similar contract as the Bears, except the Bears built in a certain amount of incentives, which they did with a lot of their free agents this offseason. They built in some incentives that the Colts weren't willing to put in their contract with Freeman, which is really questionable when you think about it, because the thing about incentives is if a player reaches them, that means he's playing very well for you.
Yeah, right.
And you're not really going to mind paying up that extra money. But the Colts decided for whatever reason not to put that in there, and they basically, I guess, cut ties and said, all right, we're going to let you walk at this point. And Freeman decided to go with the Bears. So I don't think Chuck Pagano, their head coach, was all that happy about it, because I had a chance to talk to him at the owners' meetings back in March, and just the mere mentioning of Jarrell Freeman's name got him going off on how much he loved the guy and missed him already. And that was back in March.
I love it. So, you're angering the Colts coach at meetings in March. I love it.
All I did was mention the guy's name, too. So obviously, getting back to some of that friction I just mentioned, I don't think Chuck Pagano and their general manager, Ryan Grigson, were on the same page with Jarrell Freeman.
I think the most surprising thing about Sunday's game has to be that the network Fox has assigned its A broadcast team of Joe Buck, Troy Aikman, and Aaron Andrews to the Bears-Colts game, when these two teams probably deserve, the tryout guys, the practice squad guys, the former linebackers, as opposed to the A team. Why would go with the A broadcast? Is it just markets? What would be the reason for the Bears and the Colts to get top-notch treatment from Fox?
Yeah, I don't know, because the Colts aren't necessarily a huge market down there in Indy. Obviously, Chicago always is, and that's why they still end up on these primetime games, even though they've been embarrassing themselves on those games lately. I was surprised by it. I'm not sure, but they decided to go with their A crew for a battle between two 1-3 football teams. I guess you get excited about Brian Hoyer. I don't know. It was an odd decision, especially because there are some other good games. I guess the Texans at Vikings, that's actually a CBS game. So because that's another one of the good noon games on Sunday.
And it's not really because of the Cubs, because won't the Cubs be out? They'll be like, I think on Sunday's the travel days, right? So they won't.
Maybe
Joe Buck wanted to go to Wrigley, and he's like, "Well, let's just make it that I go to the Bears." But it's in Indianapolis anyway, so
that's
my theory's been destroyed.
That's a whole other story that I don't understand. Is with the Cubs? I mean, what is baseball doing putting these games on FS1 and MLB Network?
It's crazy.
It makes no sense to me to bury. Now, on Saturday, you have a whole bunch of college football on Fox and ESPN and ESPN2, and I get all that because college football is a huge draw. But to bury this outstanding Cubs-Giants series that we're going to be treated to over the next week on these secondary sports networks is just baffling to me.
It really is. It's something we'll talk about continue to talk about, because there's a chance, I mean, especially when you get in a secondary network like MLB, that a lot of Chicagoans won't have a chance to see it. Now, I know they're offering it up, on all the services, but you still have to pay for it. I mean, if you don't pay for MLB, you don't get it. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I just switched my cable back to DirecTV, in part because for what I was paying with cable, I wasn't getting MLB Network, NFL Network, and for what I do, that's hard to do my job.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
There's a lot of people out there who don't have MLB Network, and when I saw that Saturday night's game is only on MLB, that was shocking to me.
This place is going to go up. Chicago's going to go up.
This is something a lot of people don't pay attention to until it's like literally game time.
Yeah.
And they go, all right, what channel's the game on? And then they don't realize it.
Oh,
they don't have the channel, and it's going to be chaos.
It's really, we're going to have to put a couple extra reporters on for Saturday. The beat will be all over it. Adam Hoagie covers the Bears for WGNRadio.com. You can find it at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Intentional grounding is out. The beat is on Saturday here on 720. Adam, great to talk to you, man. You got a prediction for the Bears?
I have the Bears winning 24-23. I just think the Colts are a mess right now.
All right. I like your optimism. All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Adam.
All right. See you guys.
Good start to the series already. The Giants reportedly spent 2 hours in traffic from O'Hare to Wrigley today and won't work out because of the rain. It was all a wasted trip. Hopefully they're staying at the Days Inn on Clark. Clark and Diversey.
Yeah, the Red Roof over up on Rush.
Right. They're at the Hojo on LaSalle. That's what I heard. They're at the old Ohio, the Ohio House. That's the next hour of the download, just naming ratty hotels in Chicago. Saying that's where the Giants are staying. That MLB stuff really ticks me off, man.
You know what? I heard that. Now I'm in a bad mood.
I don't understand. Like, why when the Bears play on a Thursday night, right? And it used to be an NFL Network game. A WCIU or an ABC or someone local, a local affiliate would pick it up. And you would think with WGN TV or ABC, who also does games, or even the U or CLTV, somebody would be able to be able, I don't know, if you purchase some sort of rights to be able to show the game to terrestrial TV owners in Chicago who are even basic cable owners. You're telling me I don't have MLB Network, so I'm not going to be able to watch that game at home? I got to go to a bar to watch that? That's crazy.
And that's the Saturday night game, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not – I'm sorry, man. That's unacceptable.
And it's not like the Cubs have a following across the country or anything.
I know. It's to go from the idea that WGN America used to put the Cubs on all over the country to not now having no access in the city of Chicago. Whatever. You know what? No. No. Thanks, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Thomas Jones is going to join us. Or I should say Thomas Q. Jones, the running back for the Chicago Bears 10 years ago when the Bears went to the Super Bowl, has left, obviously retired from football, and he has made a transition to Hollywood. He is now an actor, and he is in the new Netflix series, Luke Cage. So we will be talking to him about his career, both on the football field and also in the casting, I guess you say the casting room. I don't know what you call it.
You don't want to ask him about that.
Yeah, I don't want to. We'll get there. Thomas Jones coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, this weekend, a new documentary will premiere at the Siskel Center on State Street. It's produced by American Experience and PBS, and it's called Command and Control. It takes a close look at the safety of nuclear weapons, including an incident in Arkansas back in 1980, where an accident almost detonated a nuclear warhead. The film asks the question, how do you manage weapons of mass destruction without being destroyed by them? The documentary is based on the book by award-winning author Eric Schlosser. Schlosser's book was called Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. He's also the producer and co-writer of the film. Schlosser, of course, is the famed investigative reporter and author behind the books Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal, which looked at sanitary conditions, among other things, in the fast food industry, and Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. Eric Schlosser's in town for a discussion after the screening tomorrow night, or before part of the screening at the Siskel Center, and he is my guest at the big table tonight. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's such a great film, and it's something that I didn't know much about at all. Let's talk about nuclear warheads and safety protocols. What first sort of grabbed your attention about this story when you wrote the book a couple years back?
I was spending time with the Air Force. I got really interested in the future of warfare in space. And most people don't realize, but we have a U.S. Space Command and an Air Force Space Command, and they're in charge, if we go to war, in controlling outer space. So I was spending time with these guys. I was visiting some of their top secret bases. And a lot of them had been missile launch officers during the Cold War in charge of ICBMs with nuclear weapons. So when we weren't talking about laser beam weapons or particle beam weapons and directed energy beam weapons that may or may not someday be deployed in space, they started telling me stories from the Cold War about nuclear weapons, about accidents, mistakes, things that went wrong. And one of the officers told me the story of an accident at an ICBM silo in Damascus, Arkansas, in September 1980. And this is what happened. Some guys were working on the missile in the silo, just routine maintenance. They were standing on a steel work platform near the top of the missile. One of the guys dropped a tool, and it bounced on the steel work platform. He reached for it, missed it, and it fell in this narrow gap between the work platform and the missile. It fell about 70 feet, hit the silo wall, ricocheted, and hit the missile. And when it hit the missile, it ruptured a fuel tank, and suddenly there were thousands of gallons of rocket fuel pouring into the silo. And the Air Force had no idea what to do. And it was important for them to figure out what to do because the most powerful nuclear warhead the United States ever built was on top of that Titan II missile in that silo that night.
I mean, this is it pales into the hydrogen bombs and the other bombs that we've created. This is the biggest nuclear warhead ever.
This warhead was 600 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. Jeez. And the statistic that's even more mind-blowing for me is this one warhead was 3 times more powerful than all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs. So when this officer told me the story, I was like, how come I've never heard of this? This is unbelievable. And I set out to write a fairly short book that would be like a thriller telling minute by minute what happened to try to, you know, prevent this missile from exploding and to prevent the warhead from detonating. And I wound up writing a very long book about all the close calls and nuclear weapons accidents that we had that were kept from the public.
That's the part of the documentary that sort of sets up the story of Damascus, but it is the part that's really the root of your book. But, I mean, there are so many – everything from B-52 bombers to strange silo accidents and things of that nature that we've never heard of, that there have been serious accidents with serious bombs.
Yeah. You know, during the Cold War – the government felt it was really important to maintain popular support for our nuclear arsenal. And as a result, they did not want publicity of when things went wrong. And the reality is there were a number of occasions in which American nuclear weapons almost detonated on American soil in an accident and could have taken out not just cities but entire states. Now, I'd like to think this is all Hollywood stuff that I made up, but the book, you know, was based largely on interviews with people who were handling nuclear weapons, in charge of nuclear weapons during the Cold War. It's based on documents that I obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. And last night we did a screening in Palo Alto with a lot of former defense officials and nuclear weapons people from Los Alamos and Livermore, and it's true. They had no qualms with the film and found no mistakes in it. And this is the reality.
It's amazing to think about because, you know, there's a great stat in the documentary just about, you know, thought that during the Cold War, to be able to take out the Soviet Union, we needed, 50 to 70 bombs, something of that nature. And we ended up manufacturing 32,000.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show that, you know, we kind of went overboard when it came to nuclear weapons. And not only that, but it takes personnel, it takes human beings, it takes, just so many sort of protocols to keep these weapons, I guess the word would be safe in a way.
They're machines.
Yeah.
It's like you're maintaining a machine. And, you know, in the book and in the film, I try to give credit to our weapons designers, to the technicians, especially to the servicemen who risked their lives and sometimes lost their lives trying to prevent these nuclear catastrophes. And it is a testament to their skill that none of them really detonated. But the reality is, you know, like I say in the film, these are machines. It's hard to think of a machine that's never gone wrong.
Eric Schloss is my guest tonight. He's the author of Command and Control Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety, which has been turned into a documentary called Command and Control, which is produced by American Experience and PBS. Eric's also co-writer and producer on the film. It's at the Siskel Center at State Street. Starting tomorrow, you're going to have a discussion at 8 o'clock, and it's going to run through the week. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back more with Eric Schlosser here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, great author and investigative journalist. I mean, it's amazing to have Eric Schlosser in studio with us here. Thanks for being here. The author of Fast Food Nation, Reefer Madness, and of course, Command and Control Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety, which has turned into a documentary, which is Command and Control, which will be at the Siskel Center starting tomorrow. And I want to talk to you about that process, and we'll get to that. But we'll stay on nuclear weapons for a minute here. You know, it's amazing to me that this has fallen out of favor in the American populace. I mean, we don't talk about nuclear weapons. We don't talk about safety. We don't talk. There were times when there were protests and you know, protests for nuclear freeze in the 80s. But once the Cold War sort of went away, we just act as if nuclear weapons have gone away. And the only time you ever hear about it is, you know, we'll hear in this campaign, do you want this candidate to have the nuclear codes? But we don't know much about the nuclear war arsenal, warhead arsenal that remains.
Yeah. Well, I was in college in the 80s, and we all knew about it then. And there really was a feeling on college campuses that we might die any day in a nuclear war. And we now know that was true. And the people who were in charge of the government during the Reagan administration and in the Soviet Union were really afraid there might be a nuclear war. And especially in the year 1983, we came pretty close. So, you know, those of us who are, you know, 19, 20 years old, we're wondering, well, are we paranoid? Is it right to be? No. I mean, there was real reason to be afraid. But, you know, thankfully, there isn't that level of risk, but the danger never really went away. If you're a freshman in college right now, and you're 18 years old, you were born 7 years after the Soviet Union vanished. So there's no reason for you to know about these weapons and right. This sort of threat. But the danger never went away. You know, there are still thousands of weapons ready to be used. Right now, as we sit here, there are hundreds of missiles that could be launched within a minute. And people need to be aware. I'm not trying to terrify people and live in fear, but to me, this is one of the great threats that we face. And one thing I need to mention is that the documentary is directed by a good friend of mine, Robbie Kenner.
Yeah.
And we worked together on a documentary, Food Inc., which was partly based on my book, Fast Food Nation. And whereas Food Inc. was sort of an issue documentary looking at all the things wrong with our food system, this documentary, Command and Control, was our attempt to make a thriller.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it plays. It's amazing to look at the way you guys put it together. I mean, it is like a sort of suspense thriller that you'd see in the movies on TBS.
It starts off with a guy dropping a tool, and then the question in the film is, what's going to happen? Now we know that the state of Arkansas did not vanish in a fireball, but how did they solve this problem? Who gets hurt? Who doesn't make it out alive? When I was writing the book, I'd read a lot of the Cold War Tom Clancy novels, which were known as techno-thrillers. So I tried to write the book as a techno-thriller in which nothing works. Because the reality with this technology isn't that it all works perfectly mm-hmm. like in a James Bond film. It's that these are machines made by human beings, and in all kinds of unexpected ways, they mess up.
You know, one of the things, is, as you kind of mentioned, this idea of them being armed to the minute. I mean, this was sort of a byproduct of the Cold War. If the Soviet Union was going to launch, we need to be able to launch right away. That threat has changed, but that still remains, this idea that these nuclear weapons can be launched within a minute. That has to add to some of the tension. It has to add to some of the, the concern about, you know, if there's malfunctions, if things go wrong with a nuclear weapon.
Well, when you have these weapons ready to go, it's sort of like having a gun cocked, loaded, ready to fire. And it makes mistakes all the more potentially catastrophic. I mean, if a missile is launched, there's no calling it back. And if a missile with a nuclear warhead is on it, There's no deactivating the warhead remotely. You know, that 60 Minutes did a thing I helped them out with a few years ago, and an Air Force officer said, hey, once they're gone, they're gone. There's no calling them back. So we really need to think about, why do we have a sort of nuclear posture and strategy that came out of the mentality of 1963,
right,
still in the 21st century? Because this machinery is aging. These missiles are getting old. The communication systems that link the missiles to headquarters are getting old. And, you know, I was with former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry last night at Stanford. And, I mean, he has been involved in nuclear weapons really since the early 1960s. He is a very sober, stable guy. He is not prone to exaggeration. And he thinks we should get rid of all these land-based missiles because of the risk of an accidental nuclear war. Now, those three words shouldn't even be said together. Accidental nuclear war. That's just insane.
And it's amazing, too, because as more sort of, I guess, weapons of mass destruction are produced and more sort of volatile, you know, situations arise in the world, it seems like we have gone to lengths to make sure that there isn't an accidental gas attack or you know, there's, yeah, we try to find safety. But with nuclear warheads and such, it still is this possibility where we haven't created safeguards to eliminate nuclear weapons or to, I guess, be able to cancel them out if launched or if there's an accident or malfunction. There's no real safety on these
things. Well, you think of companies like Apple at the cutting edge of technology, but, you know, every now and then iTunes goes down. You know, the airline Delta recently had their whole reservation system go down. Netflix went down recently. Well, we don't want the control systems of our nuclear weapons going down and going offline that way. A few years ago, 50 of our missiles suddenly went offline, which meant that the launch crews could no longer communicate with their missiles. And that lasted for an hour. There was concern at the Air Force that someone had hacked into our nuclear command and control system and
disabled. It's like right out of a sci-fi movie, yeah.
But this is genuinely a concern now.
For all of the talk of nuclear weapons and keeping them out of the hands of terrorism or other rogue states, even Iran, you know, we talk about this. You know, where are we when it comes to either eliminating or recognizing some of the things that you're talking about in this documentary and in your book? Where are we as a society, as an American society? Where has President Obama gone? Where are we closer to saying that, you know, we recognize these threats, we recognize that this could be a problem, let's fix it?
Well, I'll give some good news. So the good news is, at the height of the Cold War between the United States and Russia, at one point there was maybe 70 to 75,000 nuclear weapons.
Wow.
And that number has come down. Now there's only 14,000 between the United States and Russia. So that's a huge decline. But when you look at what these weapons can do, I mean, one weapon can destroy an entire city. There's estimates that if 100 weapons were used in a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, it would kill a billion people. So 14,000 is still a very large number. Since the accident depicted in my film, we've done a much better job at putting safety mechanisms inside the warhead. The warhead that was involved in the accident in Damascus in 1980, it was basically Eisenhower-era technology. It was an obsolete weapon by 1980. So the weapons are safer. One of the things that concerns me is the weapon systems that we have are getting old. Like the Minuteman missile I mentioned earlier, that was put into duty in 1970. It was supposed to be retired in the early 1980s, so it was supposed to be retired 30 years ago. I was in a Minuteman underground control center the other day in North Dakota, not one that's currently in use, but that had been deactivated. But what's amazing is the computers in our launch control centers today are the same as the one that I saw. It's an IBM Series 1 computer, which was introduced in 1976. Yeah. It was the height of technological excellence in 1976. But that's the computer that's going to get the launch order from the President of the United States. And so there's all kinds of ways that the system can go wrong.
Well, it's a fascinating documentary. It's called, and I'm excited to I was great to see it, and you should go see it. It's called Command and Control. It's based on Eric Schlosser's book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety. Eric's also the producer and co-writer on the film, and he will be there for a discussion at Siskel Center tomorrow night. This will be right before, after the screening that is scheduled for that time. All right, we'll take a break. Let's get an update on tonight's news. When we come back, I'd love to talk to you about the process of taking a book to documentary form and the challenges of doing that, and also a little bit about your other works as well. Eric Schlosser, my guest tonight at the Big Table. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest at the Big Table, Eric Schlosser. A great author, Fast Food Nation. So great. And Reefer Madness, and the new documentary based on your book, Command and Control, will be at the Siskel Center coming up here tomorrow night. You're going to have a discussion about the film, about what we've been talking about, nuclear warheads, nuclear weapons, and safety issues. And it's the film is going to run as a Chicago premiere. It's going to run through the week down at the Siskel Center on State Street. For you as an author, you've worked with the director before and sort of, you know, transitioning to documentaries off your work. Talk about the difference between producing and writing a documentary and writing a piece of nonfiction.
Yeah. Well, you know, the emphasis for me is the book comes first. So I didn't entertain any notions of there being a documentary or a film until I finished the book. And I have the advantage. I mean, a lot of the book is the story of this accident. I spent hours hanging out with the guys who were there that night, the Air Force personnel who risked their lives to try to prevent this nuclear accident and try to prevent a detonation. And a lot of the book is their story. It's very different when you're making a film. And when Robbie, the director, is interviewing them, he doesn't have hours to get the story told.
Right.
He's got to get them to say on film what needs to be said to push the narration forward. And it's a real art, you know? I mean, when I'm interviewing people, I'm just kind of hanging out with them. He's got to put them on a soundstage in front of a camera with lights. And a lot of these guys have never spoken in front of a camera before. But for me, one of my favorite parts of the film is the way it honors these real heroes. Incredible. I mean, if you think about going into a missile silo with the most powerful nuclear warhead ever built and trying to save the missile, that is real heroism. And I think the interviews he did really, you know, acknowledges their valor, and there's a real emotional.
Yeah,
core
there's some
to the
depth
film.
There. There's it's not only that it's emotional. There's depth, and there's a lot of what happens in the film centers around the reaction, the Air Force's reaction. They kind of were like, "What warhead? There's no warhead. There's nothing to see here." Kind of
nothing's wrong.
Nothing's wrong. Even to the point of blaming it all on human error. Even to the point of some of the people who you said came in to deal with the fire or the vapors and the fuel. You know, almost they just weren't given their due. They weren't at all being. So there was a lot of emotion. There was a lot of you could see the sort of the reflection from some of the people in the film.
And the other thing about the film, you know, I had visited this while researching my book, but there's one Titan II missile silo left in the United States, and it's been preserved as a museum. And so they had a great, you know, library there of documents that I used for my book, and I spent time there to get a feeling for the site. But when Robbie was filming there, it's just the most amazing film set that you'd ever want. I mean, it's this underground control center with these long corridors. This missile was also the biggest missile that we ever built. It's about the height of a 10-story building. So when you're standing at the bottom of the missile and looking up, it's just incredible. And I think that, you know, the film captures that feeling of being underground, almost with a monster. I mean, one review, a good review, compared it to a horror film. And, you know, it's a horror film about this monster, and the monster is the warhead on this missile that could blow up at any minute.
And you mentioned it earlier. I mean, it feels like a thriller.
Yeah.
It also, you know, it almost parallels some of the fictional stories of sci-fi lore of somebody hijacking a warhead or, you know, the codes being, you know, we've seen these kind of stories, but we've always known them to be sort of rich in fiction. To be able to see this actually happening and the thrilling and knowing that it actually happened, you know, it's a nonfiction story of something that happened in 1980, makes it work.
It's true. And, you know, this weekend we're going to screen it in Arkansas for the community where this accident happened. And they knew that something had gone wrong, But the government denied there was any possibility of a nuclear detonation. So it's only now, and really, I mean, really since my book came out a few years ago, that this community is even aware that they were almost vaporized in 1980. I mean, the secrecy was so extreme that it became absurd. I mean, the night of the accident, Vice President Walter Mondale was in Arkansas. He was at Hot Springs for a Democratic state convention. And when he heard that there was a problem at the missile site, he wanted to know, is there a warhead on the missile? And the Air Force officer sent to brief him said, sir, I can neither confirm nor deny that there's a warhead on
that
missile.
The vice president, right?
The vice president. And I interviewed Mondale, and his response was, God damn it, I'm vice president of the United States. And eventually they told him. But, you know, that level of secrecy is insane. And as another Air Force officer later said to me, he said, what did people think was on the, you know, marshmallows? And and if they had just admitted that there was a warhead, they could have greatly reduced a lot of the panic in that area.
A lot of your work, especially the books, centers around industries that rely on secrecy, that really sort of fend off transparency. I mean, that's Fast Food Nation in a nutshell, the concept that cutting corners and making sure that the customer doesn't know about it. What's your attraction to those stories? What is it about the stories, whether it be the fast food industry or nuclear weapons and safety, that you want to write about?
You know, I came to journalism fairly late. I started out as a playwright and as a novelist and a screenwriter. And when I started doing journalism, I just wanted to do a kind of old-fashioned journalism and the obligation to sort of, sounds really corny, but serve the public interest and take on very powerful institutions that are keeping things secret. And there are certain things that should be kept secret, but I also think the public has a right to know. So with our food system, you have a right to know what you're eating and what's in your food and where it comes from. And in the case of these nuclear weapons accidents, these were really important events. These are really important things, and we have a right to know them. So I feel like it's been my job to uncover things that have been deliberately hidden from us by powerful bureaucracies, and I think it's wrong. And the other thing that I've tried to do is in all my books, and I hate doing it, but I think it's important to do it, is I have really extensive bibliography and source notes and footnotes. And I don't care if the reader ever looks at them, but if anyone wants to challenge if something is true, they can go look it up themselves. But also just, you know, as a basic principle, when all these government agencies and these corporations are trying to hide information, I want my work to be transparent.
Well, they don't want you, and they also don't want you to find it.
Right.
So, I mean, you have to have sources. You have to be able to say, this is where I found this stuff, because they'll do everything they possibly can to deny it.
And, you know, one of the struggles was getting this information on nuclear weapons accidents. If you were to do a Freedom of Information Act search and say, I want documents about nuclear weapons accidents, they'd say, well, we can't find any. I was very fortunate early on in my research that somebody gave me a document. It wasn't a classified document, but it had a long list of classified documents in it. And then when I did my Freedom of Information Act search, I had the exact name of the document and the memo.
You have to.
And the government couldn't deny that it existed because
for anyone listening out there, for journalists, you know, the Freedom of Information Act is obviously the act for you can get documents that before the act happened, whether it be the Chicago police or whether it be the NASA or whoever it is, they didn't have to give you anything.
Yeah.
Now they do, but they found a way around it, and one of it is how you ask the question. And they can be very yes or no, and if you don't ask your question the right way, if you're too generic, they can say nope or yes and give you the wrong stuff. So it's almost, I mean, it was a very, very lucky thing that you had the specific numbers to get, because otherwise you probably never would have found that.
The government also really must have wondered, how does he know that these documents exist? Because some of them were very obscure. There were a memo from one nuclear weapon designer to another nuclear weapon designer in 1961 that was top secret, but I knew the letter, I knew the date had been written. The other thing that's kind of amazing is as I was starting to get all these documents, so much of them were blacked out by the censors. But the censors are really incompetent because they'd hire different people to censor documents on the same subject. So I'd get different documents on the same subject and compare the two. And one guy had blacked out one thing, the other guy had blacked out another thing, and you could compare the two and get the full story. So there are some things that should be kept secret. But overwhelmingly what I found is the things that were being kept secret were things that were going to embarrass government bureaucrats or embarrass the Pentagon, and they just didn't want us to know.
And so many times it's about the bottom line, of course, but it's also about image. It's about, like you mentioned at the top, I mean, that this was a popularity contest. They needed to say that nuclear weapons were popular, and they couldn't have accidents after accidents after accidents that people would say, I don't want this as part of, I don't want to get behind this.
And I mean, this is going to sound really corny, but I believe it. Knowledge is power. And if the government or if corporations are trying to keep information away from you, they're trying to maintain the power and keep the public in the dark and therefore more easily controlled. So again, some things must be kept secret, but if we're going to have a democracy and as consumers, I mean, this was really true for Fast Food Nation, you know, you don't have any freedom as a consumer if you don't know where your food came from. You can't look at it and tell the difference between meat that's contaminated or meat that's clean. So, you know, that's why I do what I do.
Well, Eric Schlosser is my guest as we wrap up here. I mean, there's something about it. You think about Fast Food Nation, and it's a conversation starter in the way that before Fast Food Nation, it wasn't something that we were paying attention to, how the food was made in places like McDonald's or Burger King or other places that, you know, I don't single out one, two companies, but the idea that, you know, we didn't think about it at all. I mean, do you think about that with your books, the idea of these almost being conversation starters, whether it be migrant workers and or, you know, sort of labor injustices or, like you said, with the sanitation, the food industry, or in this case, nuclear weapons? I mean, these are conversation starters.
Well, you know, you're right on the mark. I mean, if you read any one of my books, I'm really not trying to tell anybody what to think. It's not like a polemic, a dogmatic argument. It's basically what I've found in my research. I'm trying to get people to think. I'm trying to provide information to them that they may not get from the mainstream media, they may not get from other sources. And I'm trying to do it in a way that's a pleasure to read, you know. And for me, it's really interesting because I learn about all these subjects. I mean, I never would have known about nuclear weapons before. And I feel, you know, it's what I do is to try to expose these things that are being kept hidden.
Can you tell us what you're working on?
I have been working for many, many years on a book on the American prison system.
Oh, man.
And I hope to finish it this year. And again, these prisons are out of sight. They're out of mind. And what's happening in these prisons is really important for every one of us.
I can't thank you enough. Eric Schlosser, the award-winning author of books like Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal, also Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market, and Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and The Illusion of Safety, which has been turned into a documentary produced by American Experience and PBS. It's going to be at the Siskel Center starting tomorrow night, the Chicago premiere. It's going to run a week, but tomorrow night you will be there at 8 o'clock having a discussion about the book. So if you want to come out and meet Eric and also listen to the discussion, it's at the Siskel Center here on State Street in downtown Chicago. Eric Schlosser, thanks so much for being my guest at the Big
Thanks
Table.
For having me, man.
Love that combo. Eric Schlosser. That's a great thing. I love this job in the way that, you know, the ability to talk to, you know, an amazing author. I mean, Fast Food Nation is, I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, we weren't talking about fast food at all. All the stuff you think in your head right now where you're like, ugh, God, ugh, fast food, ugh, so bad for you. That comes from somewhere. And it comes from Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, where he really looks into what is in chicken nuggets. You know, like, I mean, that's a huge. For all of that, I mean, Supersize Me, all those kind of, all the Food Inc. he was talking about, the documentaries and things, that's after. That's all inspired. That all came from what Eric was writing about. But it's great. I mean, it's, I think it's awesome, you know, to think about it just for a second, to think about WGN Radio and the concept that Milt Rosenberg was here for years and be able to do those kind of interviews with guys and to have that space again to talk about these issues and stretch out a little bit, like the Big Table does. I think that's great. I mean, a guy like Eric Schlosser, they don't even tour those guys anymore. You hear him, he's like, I'm at Stanford, then I'm in North Dakota, then I'm going to Damascus. He doesn't even stop and do media because they only give these guys 2 or 3 minutes. You know, I mean, if you check out the other places that are doing segments with authors, it may be a TV station, like a morning show, and that's a 3-minute segment. So the ability to sit down with somebody who is such a tastemaker and someone who has actually changed, you know, policy in this country to say I'm going to stop in Chicago, I'm going to come to Trim Tower, and I'm going to come to WGN Radio. That's awesome. Yeah. Also coming up next, Thomas Jones. That's, again, I love it. This, I mean, last night was a jam-packed show, and it was a very eclectic show. Tonight seems to be the same. We go from talking about nuclear warheads and the strange, sordid history of accidents to Thomas Jones. And after Thomas Jones, we're going to talk about the Elmhurst Art Museum's new installation. It's called Blow Up. Inflatable art, essentially like the balloons you see at Macy's Day Parade, but more artistic in a museum. It's really great. I went out there the other Saturday. I have a picture of it. I have to put it up, but it's so cool. It's like, it's, I don't know. It's like, there's something about it. Like the artists are really, really thoughtful and thought provoking with the work. So we'll talk with them coming up at 9:30. And then Greg Flamm is going to be here. DuPage Picker. We're going to talk to him. It's Swap Meet. 312-981-7200. We should do a Chicago Cubs special swap meet tonight. What do you have? What do you have from Chicago Cubs memorabilia, swag? Tell me anything about what you have. Like, I got Greg Maddux's glove from 1989. What do you got?
Remember they used to have... Excuse me, I'm getting choked up thinking about it. They used to have where you kids can go on the field and take pictures, picture day or whatever. And so, you know, I took pictures, you know, Bill Buckner or something like that. I don't even remember the players. But I remember going to the Ivy and taking a piece of ivy off the wall. And I don't know, thinking that it would last forever, I was eight or something. I took the ivy off the wall and I put it in a plastic bag, like a Ziploc bag, and like put it away in my desk or something.
You still have it, do you?
No, I think I went like a week later and it was gone. It was like
dissolved into the plastic, right? Wow, there's so many good things I can think about. I mean, just the Cubs stories alone. I mean, I've told a couple of the stories just about, and I'll save them for the swap meet. But I have some funny stories with players and going to the gymnasium at the local high school to get Bill Buckner's autograph. You know, like going there with your dad, and your dad says something embarrassing while you're like got your Little League hat on. You know, will you sign this program?
Yeah, sure. What's your name?
You know. Wouldn't want to be there with that bushy mustache. So many stories and so many things we've collected around the Chicago Cubs. So call in tonight, 312-981-7200 for Swap Meet. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, it's hard to imagine that it's been 10 years since the Bears went to the Super Bowl. All this year, we're tracking down some of the players, coaches, and staff associated with that great team. One of the stars on the offensive side of the ball was good old number 20, Thomas Jones. The running back was the workhorse for that team, almost carrying the whole Bears offense on his back. He left the Bears to play for the Jets and the Chiefs. But since his retirement, you don't see Thomas Jones reporting from the sidelines or doing play-by-play or even owning a car dealership. No, Thomas Jones has reinvented himself as Thomas Q. Jones, the actor. Jones played the role of Comanche in the new Marvel superhero show Luke Cage on Netflix. This after a role in Straight Outta Compton. Jones' acting career is on the rise, and he joins us tonight. Thomas Q. Jones, welcome to the Download.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. Bear it down.
I mean, it's great to talk to you. I mean, it is. I mean, it's unbelievable to think that that was 10 years ago. I mean, when you think back, is it fond memories for you to be a part of that team that went to the Super Bowl?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's probably the highlight of my career. I mean, to be able to go to the Super Bowl for the Chicago Bears. I mean, it's an iconic team, iconic city. Yeah, I mean, with the team that we had, I mean, it was an incredible experience, something I'll never forget. And I did not want to leave Chicago, just so all the Bears fans know. I didn't want to leave. I'm thankful that I went to the Jets. I had a great, great time there in New York, and it was an incredible experience. But I did not want to leave. I would have hoped to have come back the next season and finished the deal for you guys. So I wanted to say that on the record. I did not want to leave. Going to the Super Bowl was an incredible experience. And even the year before that, you know, going to the playing a divisional game, because my first year there, we were 5-11, and then we were able to turn it around and go 11-5, and then 13-3, and Yeah, it was just a great, great experience. I'll never forget it.
You played for a couple teams in the NFL. Talk about the experience of playing here in Chicago. What was great and not so great about playing for the Chicago Bears faithful?
There weren't too many things that were not so great. I mean, even my first year there when I came with Lovey, we had a tough year. You know, we had a lot of injuries. We were 5-11. But the one thing that I really love and respect about Chicago is that the city stuck behind us. And they love the Bears. They love the team. Win or lose, they're there. And it just gives you that much more motivation to want to win for them, especially win the Super Bowl. And the best thing was probably going to Soldier Field the morning of the game and coming out for warm-ups and just seeing the stadium and just knowing the history there. You know, also just knowing that, you know, I was playing for a team that, you know, one of my idols growing up played for, Walter Payton. I had a picture of him in my locker at the stadium and at the practice facility. And, you know, it's just it's very rare that you get a chance to do the exact same thing that one of your idols did. So there's a million great things about Chicago, even the cold. I mean, I didn't I'm from Virginia and I'm used to the cold, but Chicago cold is it's a whole
it's a different thing,
animal.
Right?
But, you know, you start to take pride in it when it starts to get cold because other teams come there and they're not used to it, and it's an advantage for us. And, you know, it's something that we're known for. I mean, you know, to be able to play in, you know, 5-degree weather or, you know, -5-degree weather, it's, I mean, mentally, you know, we had an advantage on a lot of teams, and you start to take pride in that. You know, yeah, you guys are coming out. You guys are coming into our territory where it's freezing cold. But, you know, it's not phasing us. You know, we didn't wear sleeves, and I don't know. It was just, there was a lot of nostalgia and a lot of mystique there. So it was a great experience.
When we think back to 10 years ago, I mean, one of the issues, you know, football is a fickle business. You know, and the Chicago Bears drafted Cedric Benson, and there was all this talk of him being the replacement, he being the future running back. But what I think Bears fans really, really loved about you is that you upped your game. You even got competitive in a way, and it showed on the field. You weren't just going to give up your job as running back because they drafted a kid. And that was a contentious part of the game while you were here with the Bears, the fact that Cedric Benson was always in the wings.
Yeah, I mean, I was a 7th pick overall, and I went to Arizona, and Michael Pittman was there when I went to Arizona, and he welcomed me with open arms. And, I mean, of course, we knew we were going to be competing, and you know I was a first-round pick, and the politics were there. But he didn't hold that against me. You know, he respected me as a person. He respected me as a player. He saw my ability. And we were both competing, you know, but we also wanted to win and make the team better. But when I got to, you know, the Bears, I treated Cedric the same way. You know, when he came in, I mean, clearly I didn't think they should have drafted a running back. I mean, I had almost 1,000 yards and 7 touchdowns, really, with 5 quarterbacks and, mm-hmm. you know, on a 5-11 team. You know, I mean, I played hard the whole year. I even played hurt. You know, to think they were going to draft a running back with the first pick, the 4th pick, I was a little surprised because I felt like we needed, some other players. You know, we didn't have a top receiver. You know, Rex had been hurt. You know, I just thought there were a lot of other places we could use that pick, but, you know, that's not my job. So when they drafted him, I welcomed him in the same way that I was welcomed when I came to Arizona. And unfortunately, the relationship didn't really work out that well. He didn't really receive it the way I thought he would. And I think he underestimated who I was. You know, I mean, I had been through a lot of situations, you know, going through Arizona and struggling and then, you know, going to Tampa for a year and then finally getting some good momentum and then coming to Chicago as the guy. I was the guy. I came with Lovey. You know, that was my team. You know, I turned into a leader on the team. I mean, it was my job. I didn't care that he was a 4th pick in the draft. That really had nothing to do with anything. You know, it was about what you do on the field. And I was glad that they drafted him. You know, it gave me an opportunity to – I knew my ability, but, you know, it gave me an opportunity to prove to other people, hey, you know, I'm the guy. This is why I signed a 4-year deal here. And, you know, and it's good competition. There's nothing wrong with competition. I've never run from competition in my life. I always embrace competition because it always makes you better and takes you to the next level. And, you know, I'm very grateful they drafted him because – the competition did take me to another level. I mean, I was ready to go there anyway. Just it was my 5th, 6th year in the league. But, yeah, having him there and having those expectations they had of him and then kind of writing me off, yeah, it pissed me off. And it made me play pretty angry. So.
Yeah, we loved it, man. I got to say, like, you playing angry was one of the greatest watching you. I mean, obviously, playing in Chicago as a running back with running backs like Walter Payton and even, to an extent, Neil Anderson and Gale Sayers, obviously, before that. I mean, there have been a lot of great running backs that came to Chicago that the city embraced, and I think it's the same with you. Do you still feel that love? I mean, when you're different places and people from Chicago see you, do you feel that love from Chicago Bears fans?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that experience is unique. I mean, playing for the – I mean, there's Bears fans everywhere. I was I went to Brazil in 2011, and I was just walking. I was staying in Copacabana, and I was walking on the beach, and it was like four Bears fans. You know, like in South America, I mean, they're everywhere, you know, and I live out in Hollywood and Miami and back and forth, but I'm really in Hollywood. And there's, I mean, so many Bears fans that are casting directors and directors and producers. And,
that's got to help.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, they just, they love the Bears, man. The Bears, I mean, they're an iconic team. I mean, Chicago Bears, and that's why I think I was so torn between, you know, my contract situation and staying because during the playoffs, they would show the parade. I'm sorry, at the hotel.
Yeah.
Instead of the Hilton, they would show the parade. And, I mean, that's all I could think about was winning the Super Bowl and then having a parade and seeing all those Bears fans. And when it didn't happen, it was pretty devastating, to be honest. Something you never get over. It's almost kind of like the girlfriend you never got over, you know, that broke up with you and you still care about her. That's kind of what it is, you know. Every year, me and either Brian Urlacher or a couple of people, we find a way to text each other during Super Bowl weekend and, like, how do we lose that game?
Oh, man.
Playing in Chicago is just nothing like that, man. I mean, the helmets, the field, the stadium, the columns at the stadium, there's just too much there to ever forget it. Going to Gibson's after the game, you win, you walk in, you get a standing ovation. Oh, yeah, it's an incredible Yeah, it's incredible.
Thomas Jones is my guest. You know, and I want to make a transition because you made a transition in your career. I mean, obviously, when you retired from football, you had done some stuff. I know your brother, too, had done some reality TV. But talk about the transition from playing professional sports, from being an athlete to being a professional actor. I mean, you have made the move to, I mean, we saw you in Straight Outta Compton, obviously Luke Cage, which is a huge hit on Netflix. But talk about the transition you made from being an athlete to being an actor.
Well, when I retired in 2012, I spent about 8 months afterwards just kind of letting my body heal up and then kind of getting adjusted to being out in the real world and not being in an NFL environment. And it was pretty tough, to be honest. I've always been, you know, ambitious, and I've always had drive, and there have been so many different things that I wanted to accomplish and do outside of football. But football has been my life since I was 7 years old. You know, at that time I was 33. So, it, you know, for about 8 months, it was tough. I never really was a drinker. I felt myself kind of drinking a lot and drinking, especially when I woke up. You know, I would go to the gym and literally I would have had a few drinks before I went to the gym. I mean, it just didn't make any sense. I didn't even understand why. I think it was just something that I was kind of depressed a little bit. And then I started to produce this TV series, a small TV series in Miami, and I started acting in it. And that's kind of when I got the acting bug, and it felt really good because it was just something new, something challenging, something I hadn't done before. And then I think from that point, I started to go on some auditions. I got cast for a couple of projects early on, Shameless, the show called Comedy Bang Bang. And then I was cast for this other show called Being Mary Jane on BET.
BET,
and
right.
then that's when I was like, okay, I have a shot. You know, I need to take it serious. So that's when I came to L.A. and got into actor studios so I could actually learn the craft and know what I'm doing. Because it could go one of two ways. You know, it could go really great. Or if you don't know what you're doing and you're, like, really bad, it could go really bad. You could embarrass yourself. So, you know, I didn't want the latter, definitely. So I got into actor studios, and then I really started to enjoy it and became therapy for me. Acting became therapy. I was able to take all of the raw emotion from my life, raw emotion from football that I was able to use and just transfer all of that emotion and energy into my characters.
When you think about that, when you think about emotion and you think about that transferring that emotion and just – the raw feel that goes with playing a sport into being an actor. What are the similarities? I mean, are there similarities from being a football running back to being an actor on set? I mean, is there a part of acting that is in football? I mean, is there things that you can lean on from your past career?
Yeah, I mean, when I get to the stadium, you know, we play a 12 o'clock game in Chicago. When I wake up Sunday morning, I'm already kind of transitioning into a character, you know, going from Thomas Jones or TJ, or my friends call me, to Thomas Jones number 20, you know. And by the time I get to the stadium, you know, I have to become number 20. Yeah. You know, I don't have to become, I'm a captain, I'm a leader, I'm someone that has to vocally lead the team and someone that has to find energy, find anger, find emotion, find a reason to want to, you know, hit somebody, find a reason to want to win besides my paycheck. You know, so you turn into this different person. And, you know, with that being said, you know, a lot of people don't really understand, you know, that process. And that's why some guys don't really know how to turn it off once they get on the field. But it's the same thing as an actor. You know, you have a character, you have a script. You know, you buy into the character, you buy into the character's objectives, and then you commit. You know, on the football field, you know, if you run timid, you're going to get hurt. You know, as an actor, if you don't commit, no one's going to believe you. You know, you have a playbook. The more you know your playbook, the more you know your plays, the more you can react. You know, if you have an outside zone play, if I don't know where the blocking is supposed to be or where the tackle's going to block, then I can't react if he misses his block because I didn't know who he was blocking in the first place. But if I do know it and he misses his block, then I know how to react. I can cut back inside or I can bounce it outside or I can make the in miss. Same thing in the, with a script. If you don't know your script, you don't know your lines, you can't be organic. You can't be natural. You're too busy thinking about your next line. And what am I supposed to say? But the more you know your lines, then you can be organic. You can let the other actor affect you. You can listen to what they're saying more because you already know your line, and it's not about the line. It's about how you really feel about what's being said to you. There's a lot of similarities there, and that's what I found to be therapeutic because as a football player, you're taught to be tough and don't show weakness, don't show vulnerability. But on the flip side, as an actor, you can't. You have to be vulnerable. You have to show weakness because every human being has vulnerable moments and weak moments in their life, and that's when an audience can really connect with you as an actor and start to like you as an actor. So,
Thomas Jones, my guest, former Chicago Bear running back now, actor in Hollywood. He's in the new show, Luke Cage, which is the Marvel superhero show, which is on Netflix. Talk about that. I mean, you're playing Comanche. You're playing a actual comic book character. And, you know, we sort of see the origin stories of the character. But talk about, getting this role and being on the show and also, you know, essentially being in a superhero serial. What did you know about comic books, about Marvel, before you got involved with this project?
I mean, I grew up watching Spider-Man and, you know, Superman and you know, all those cartoons and reading the comics and stuff. But I didn't know too much about Luke Cage. I think that came out in the early 70s, and I was born in 78, so I wasn't really too familiar with Luke Cage, mm-hmm. to be honest. But when I went on the audition, I actually had to audition four times. I mean, it's Marvel, Netflix, a big deal. So, you know, and because I was a newer actor, most of the actors on the show have been around for a long, long time, right. So they were a lot more comfortable. But, you know, I did a really good job in my audition, and they were like, you know, it was pretty much this guy has to be in it somewhere. So I didn't know even who Comanche. I didn't even audition for Comanche. I auditioned for another role. I didn't even know who Comanche was. And they were like, well, he booked the role. And I'm like, okay, I got it. And they're like, but it's not the one he read for. And I'm like, what? You know, like, so, yeah, the Comanche was just a role they like, trust us. Comanche is perfect for him. And so I started to do research on it. And then I realized, like, wow, this is a really cool comic. And Comanche is one of the original members of the Rivals gang, Luke Cage, Comanche, Stryker, and Shades. And then I started to understand more of the storyline and where Comanche fit in, and I was really excited about it. And I shot in New York last October. And then my character was one of the characters that they didn't want to announce it. They wanted to keep my character a special character because a lot of people, they didn't want people to know that Comanche was even in the series. And I think that's what kind of shocked people, not only that it was because it was me, but because they didn't even think Comanche was in it because it hadn't been announced on IMDb or on any articles. So they were like, well, maybe Comanche's not in it, like the real comic book people that are, you know, into the comics. So it was really cool. It was a really cool role. It was a lot of fun. It's so funny because roles like that where I have to play a villain or I have to play a bad guy, I just go back to football. I go back to pregame. I go back to just being reckless and not really caring about what happens to me because in football, that's how you have to be, you know, especially when you're a running back. I mean, you're constantly getting hit. You know, you're going to get hit before the game starts. And you kind of embrace that and you embrace the unpredictability of it, and then you get, and then it becomes a rush, and then that's how I am with those roles. Like Straight Outta Compton is the same thing. It's I go back to pregame. It's like I'm playing the Packers in Lambeau. you know, that's what I'm thinking. What was I thinking before I came out of the tunnel? What was I thinking before the first kickoff? You know, what am I thinking when someone, you know, tries to, you know, scratch my eyes under the pile, or when I run a guy over? What am I thinking? What do I see? how am I feeling? And that's the emotion that I put into that scene.
Well, you know, everybody in Chicago, we're Thomas Jones fans, but we want to say we're also Thomas Q. Jones fans because watching you, great performance in Luke Cage, which is on Netflix now. You can also see you've got some projects coming up, but you've also run Straight Outta Compton as well, Suge Knight's Bodyguard. Thomas Jones, great to talk to you. Thanks for checking in with us. And, you know, if you get through Chicago, please hit us up because we'd love to talk more about your craft, about, you know, the transition and continuing your excelling in acting. Thomas Jones, thanks for joining us tonight. We appreciate
definitely.
It. Thank you.
Hey, Bear Down, Chicago Bears fans, I'm watching you this season. Trust me, you guys will get better this year. I know it's tough now, but I'm rooting for you.
Thank you, Rob. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Greg Flam's going to be here. We're going to do Swap Meet. Tonight, we want to do very specific. I mean, we do any of it. We'll do all of it, right? It's essentially a Chicago antique roadshow. You call in with your memorabilia, your junk, whatever you have that you think might be worth something. We will evaluate it. But I like how it's evolved over the weeks, where it's really just call in and brag about the stuff you have and the stuff that you didn't throw away. And I kind of threw out right before we started the 9 o'clock hour that we should do Chicago Cubs memorabilia because the Cubs are in the playoffs starting Friday. And I've already gotten several awesome memorabilia / stories about run-ins with Chicago Cubs and also memorabilia. Like somebody said, they have a signed baseball from Ryan Dempster. Someone said they were in back in the 80s, they were Bill Buckner's babysitter. It's a good start, huh? This is going to be a good hour coming up at 10 o'clock. 312-981-7200. What do you want to brag about? That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Well, right now, let's talk about a new art exhibit that's on display at the Elmhurst Art Museum. It's called Blow Up, Inflatable Contemporary Art. And it's exactly what you would expect. It's inflatable art. This isn't your Macy's Day Parade Fair, but instead projects and installations that take on social issues and big picture ideas mixed with textures and a skill that goes with creating large works of art. In studio with me tonight, a couple of the artists. Claire Ashley is a featured artist in the show and also an adjunct professor of contemporary practices, drawing and painting at the School of Art Institute. Claire, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Diane Christensen is a Chicago artist who's been shown in several galleries here in Chicago, and her piece, Inflatable Opera, Birth, Death, Breath, is in the show. Diane, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
And also Jenny Gibbs is here. Jenny is the executive director at the Elmhurst Art Museum. Jenny, thanks for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Why don't we start with you, Jenny? Mm-hmm. I'm interested in where this idea came from to have an inflatable art exhibit at the museum.
Sure. Well, it's actually a traveling show. It was curated by Carrie Lederer, who is in California. We thought it's just, we have the perfect space for it. We have these great 18-foot ceilings, and we're a very family-based, family-oriented community and museum, and this is a really nice way of bringing in a lot of heavy content, but with literally lighter-than-air material.
When you go through the concept of bringing in a traveling exhibition, mm-hmm. what is it that you're looking for at the Elmhurst Art Museum? What is it that you're trying to sort of engage with the community around
mm-hmm.
you?
One of my tests is sort of, is there required reading? If you need to read a wall of text for the work to work, then it's not working for us, because we are not in the city of Chicago. We're in Elmhurst. We have a very sophisticated population. But if you're looking for the Art Institute, you're going to go to the Art Institute. So we want things that are very accessible, interactive, that are fun. And we want to kind of do our own thing. We're not trying to be the MCA in the suburbs. We are trying to be our own museum. And so this and the Playboy show that we just had up have been a way for us to kind of test the ground and cover material. We'd like to be the museum of everything. It's sort of history and science and art. Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah,
I also am the guy who reads all the text. So
yeah.
Claire, let me talk to you. I'm interested. What drew you to this exhibit? What was it about being a part of this exhibit that got you involved?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been making inflatable objects for about 10 years now, and I'm trained as a painter, but I've spent 20 years trying to figure out how to make paintings without making paintings. I make work that is a kind of in response to having kids and to being really serious about abstract painting, but also loving the idea of humor, the idea of painting sort of existing in a much more accessible realm.
I'll ask, I mean, for you as a painter, as someone who doesn't want to do paintings,
yeah,
what drew you to the concept of creating inflatable work? I mean, because there's a lot of different places to,
yes,
to be able
exactly.
to try.
Well, it was over the years, like watching my kids on bounce houses and with cuddly toys, and really my work, the way I make work is at extremes of things. I either make really giant work or really tiny work. And so the inflatable work is a way for me to make really sort of monumental sculpture and monumental painting, but for me to be able to fold it and pick it up by myself. I'm sort of a feisty, independent Scot. And I hate asking people for help.
Yeah.
And as a woman, I also, as a female artist, I was sort of really interested in taking up space and sort of having a meeting of the minds with those big monumental dudes, right, who make heavy steel sculpture. Yeah. But I wanted the work that I make to be more bodily, to be more lightweight, to be more flexible and have more mobility to it in such a way that I could come in, go, whoa, and then leave again within a, you know, an hour or two's period of time. So, and then Stacey Boris, who was the curator at Elmhurst, actually showed my work to Carrie in California. Mm-hmm. So that's really the only reason I'm in the show is that sort of our local curators were aware of my work and sort of got me involved in the project.
Diane, let's talk about your involvement in the project. How'd you get involved?
Well, I too am a painter. I'm a painter and an animator, and then I work on these large installation projects. And my collaborator, Jean Dunning, and I had this idea and brought it to me. So this is a one-off. We're not in the business of making inflatable art. She does much more photography and video work, but we're both very interested in the idea of life, where it emerges mm-hmm. from, where it goes when we pass, mm-hmm. and Eastern philosophy as it applies to this. So all of this came about that she wanted to do a project where inflatables were flat and came to life. And then she thought, what should they do? Maybe they should sing. And I'm a musician, a career musician, as is my husband. And so she brought it to me because I love the absurd and I love mm-hmm. All things involved with death and what that means. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like a big bummer, but it's actually really, really fun in that the piece is flat and then these things rise up and sing, and they're singing about these existential questions. So it was an idea that she and I had, and Stacy was really familiar with my painting work and my animation work, and she and I actually ran into each other at a show, and she said, what are you working on? And I mm-hmm. said, oh, I'm doing this one project with so-and-so to be shown there, and then I'm working on this nutty inflatable opera where we're making these things inflate and sing. And she said, wait, what? She said, I've got this
Can
show.
Can you believe right. something that I'm doing?
Right. Yeah, right. And yeah. so that's how it all fell together.
Well, I mean, there's something great about it. I mean, I went out and saw the show. The beauty of it is, and I think you kind of hit it on the head, this concept that you can really go into sort of heavy thoughts and, mm-hmm. and expressive ideas, and it's juxtaposed to this light and almost childlike mm-hmm. experience of inflatables. Mm-hmm. And talk yeah. about that. I mean, I don't remember the name of the piece, but the two pink bunnies. But that's a piece that where I'm like, well, on the surface, it's just two bunnies that have been crammed into the space, mm-hmm. and you're like, well, that's kind of fun, and it's, mm-hmm. oh, this is so cute. But when you read the artist's statement about sort of really taking on sort of how pop culture kind of plays out with cute images in Japan and Tokyo, right. I mean, there's something to it. So talk about that as artists. Talk about the idea of taking really sort of Absolutely. Thoughtful ideas and mm-hmm. applying it to and juxtaposing it to right. something very light and fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, absolutely. I think that that we're sort of all really seriously engaged in a way that play and humor and dark humor can be embedded in the work. And I really like, in terms of Gene and Dan's conversation about breath and life and death. And I think the great thing about inflatables is that they are not balloons, right? So they are actually constantly breathing into the space where they exist. So there is that inhale, exhale sort of component, literally, physically in the object, that I really appreciate. And I do, for my work, I really do like that these objects, I want to make objects that have an uncanny relationship to some kind of figural reference without you necessarily being able to put your finger on it, and that they act as characters, as beings, as life things. The bunnies is the same thing, right? They're these on the surface playful things, but they are put under a lot of pressure. Yeah. They are captive. They are stuck. They have nowhere to go, right? And I think that is a definite part of the way that I think about my work, in relationship to that, those existential questions. Right?
Jenny, let me ask you, I there is something about the concept, as you just mentioned, Claire, that the concept of almost the inflatables living and breathing in the space. Mm-hmm. There are some that are laid out, you know, there are some that are crammed in. Mm-hmm. How much does the actual environment play into putting an installation like this together?
Oh, mm-hmm. A great deal. I mean, the when you're talking about the bunnies, Momoyo Toramitsu's work, and the title of that work is Somehow I Don't Feel Comfortable. So we did a lap with the bunnies around the museum, which is not an easy task, mm-hmm. to find the space in which they would look most uncomfortable. And I think it's so effective. Because again, they're literally in a box, and you can understand that even if you're not a Japanese American female, we all understand these pressures to conform, to be in a certain way. And then Luis Del Soto's work, I think you're thinking of with a sleeping Buddha, which he's just sort of transcendent and in repose in the center of a large gallery. Needs a lot of airspace, and that's where it was important.
I guess I have to ask the question. I mean, does this encompass all of the inflatable artists of our time in one exhibit? I mean, or is this a movement or a genre that, I just was introduced to it. I was fascinated by it, but I thought this was, I mean, just on the surface and being curious to the concept of putting this together. But there is a movement to do inflatable art, mm-hmm. and not in just country, but around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paul McCarthy is another big-time artist, mm-hmm. who has over his career done a number of different inflatables, and that are more are very, very dark humor, mm-hmm. But are more sort of these iconic symbolic shapes that we all recognize. I think the group of artists in this show is really interesting because there is a range of ways that artists are using inflatables as a way to think about scale, to think about weight, to think about iconic symbolic imagery that sort of speaks at multiple levels. And that some artists are sending out to China to get the pieces made. Some artists are working with companies in the States to get them made. One artist, the Trans Am piece, the artist worked with a car painting company. Mm-hmm. I think I'm one of the few people that actually makes them myself.
Fascinating. That's...
And I think it just, there's a huge movement. I'm not sure exactly why.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we wrap up, Diane, I want to give you the last word. You know, you've worked in a lot of different styles with your art. As working on the inflatable opera, do you see yourself doing more of it? Do you see that you're sort of intrigued by the notion and or the construct and the process that went into this piece?
Yeah, I am. I'm always really interested in the interface between music and mm-hmm. and art. And this is an amazing way to realize that. But I also love, in our piece, there's a real abstraction to it when everything's deflated. And I feel like that's just the beginning of me exploring that sort of abstraction to character, which I do in my animation as well, where there may be very abstract elements that then later emerge into character. And so I don't know where it'll go, but I know my first instinct is to make drawings of my experience of this flatness come to life.
That's what it is. It's a tremendous exhibit, Blow Up Inflatable Contemporary Art at the Elmhurst Art Museum. If you haven't been out to the Elmhurst Art Museum, I highly recommend it. Jenny Gibbs is the executive director at the Elmhurst Art Museum. Diane Christensen, Chicago artist, whose piece Inflatable Opera, Birth, Death, Breath is in the show. And also Claire Ashley is a featured artist in the show and an adjunct professor of contemporary practices, drawing and painting at the School of the Art Institute. Thank you all for coming in, and thank you very much for talking about your art.
Thanks so much.
All right, coming up, we are going to talk with Greg Flam, Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Excited to do some Cubs memorabilia. If you got some baseballs that have been signed, some jerseys, even some good stories about run-ins with Cubs from the past or even from the present, let us know tonight, 312-981-7200. Let's play Swap Meet, shall we? I think we should. Oh, how I missed this segment. Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Swap Meet is in the building. Greg Flam, DuPage Picker. Good to see you, Greg. How are you?
Good, Justin. Thanks for having me again.
No, I love having you, man. And, you know, this is a good week. We got a lot of good stuff we're going to talk about. Of course, the Swap Meet is like Chicago's Antiques Roadshow, except we've evolved it over time to say just it's a great segment for you to call up, to text in, to brag about all the great stuff you have.
Exactly, yeah.
Good memorabilia, good anything that you might have that, you know, we may say it's junk, but you say it's history.
Right. It's always fun.
312-981-7200. And I have to say that tonight, I think we should do some Cubs related, because every week we have Cubs memorabilia referenced. You know, we'll get people saying, I've got this ball signed, or I've got this jersey, or I've got Sean Dunstan's toothpick, you know, or something of that nature.
Got a plate from the stadium club.
Right. No lights at Wrigley. Whatever it is, this is the night to shine. 312-981-7200 in honor of the Cubs starting the playoffs. Let's get some Chicago Cubs memorabilia on the lines. Again, 312-981-7200. Besides the Cubs stuff, and you see a lot of Cubs stuff, I would assume, coming through, whether it be on eBay or flea markets.
A lot of estate sales, garage sales always have Cubs and Bears stuff, you know, some Sox stuff. The most common Cubs thing I'm trying to think would be usually a pennant would have to be the most common Cubs thing.
That's the thing that everyone goes for?
Yeah, I've got the 84 one, I think, with the team, all the names on the team. You were talking about that series earlier.
But, yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
84, 89. I think, I'm trying to think, like I have a great, and I also think stories count. Right. I think a good story, because I'll tell a story about, I was referenced a little earlier, Bill Buckner was doing something where he came to the local high school. And so my dad, we stood in the line, it snaked through to get there. Bill was in a, you know, like essentially like a folding card table, you know, from the cafeteria signing things. And he could care less. He couldn't even look up.
Right.
And my dad goes, my dad actually says to him, he goes, hey, Billy, my son, you know, he doesn't like to tie his shoes, you know, tell him about ankles, you know, your ankles. And Buckner goes, tie your shoes. That was essentially it. He didn't even look up.
I have visions of like a Christmas Story where he's going through the whole stairwell, you'll shoot your eye out thing. Yeah.
So that's my Buckner story. There are others that have already texted in. Let's read this one. I like this one a lot. In the mid-80s, this is 773. I used to babysit for Bill Buckner's kids. He was always nice. I lived in Northbrook. He and his wife were friends with people across the street from my mom's house. The two families often socialized. When the parents would go out on a weeknight or weekend night, I would watch the kids for both families. Everyone paid well.
Very nice.
A lot of good stories about Bill Buckner.
That's an awesome memory.
Also, 219's got a Carlos Zambrano story. Ran into Carlos Zambrano at Gun World in Bensonville. taking target practice before a game one time.
Before or after the Gatorade incident?
maybe he couldn't get into the target range, so he took it out on that. Also tonight, let's see, I've got, this is from Sid. 312, he says, this is Sid. I'm texting in about the signed ball from Ryan Dempster. Wanted to share this because I think it's pretty cool. I'm 11 and a big fan of the show.
Oh, wow.
And it's a signed baseball. And you know what I like about it, Sid, is that it is in a glass box.
That's how you do it.
That's how you do it, Sid. You're 11 years old, and you're already beating half the callers that call in and go, it's wrinkled up in the back of my closet.
Right.
That's how I would do it.
And he's got the single signature, not the team thing, where we talked about it devalues with the whole team on it.
All right, so 312-981-7200. Sans Cubs stuff, what do we got from you tonight?
Today I just brought in Ideal Toys made all these games in the 60s and 70s, and I brought
That's
in...
That's the name of a company?
Ideal, yeah, Ideal Company, and they were out of, I think, New York. But I have a 1964 game called Crazy Clock Game, which is the precursor to Mousetrap Game.
All right.
So that's what it was called before it evolved into Mousetrap. But it's in great condition. It's, you know, I just brought it in. You know, I found it probably last week, $4 or something. And it's worth about $80 to $100.
Oh,
so
nice,
it was a
score.
Good find. Yeah,
nice score.
It was a good find.
All right.
But yeah, you know me with my toys and. But yeah, maybe next episode I'll bring all the Cubs stuff in.
Yeah, well, we'll
be in
be
the thick of it.
Thursdays, right?
Right.
All right, so let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Greg Flamm. We'll continue the swap meet. 312-981-7200. Call now, and we'll get you in queue as well as text to see if any of your Chicago memorabilia, Chicago Cubs memorabilia, might be worth something. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. We asked, you have delivered. The lines are lit up. We've got a lot of great texts coming in as well. 312-981-7200, which is the swap meet. Greg Flamm in studio at 2PagePicker, both on Twitter and Facebook. And we have a lot of great things to talk about. And again, with the swap meet, you can evaluate some of the memorabilia you have or some of the cool stuff, antiques, things that you have. That's all possible. But at the same time, you can just brag about some stuff that you think's cool.
Right.
Let's go to Doug. Doug, I think, wants to brag. What do you got, Doug?
Hey, so I won tickets from WGN to a Cubs game. I was in the 100 section there. And went in with my camera and a very large lens. SLR, obviously. No big deal.
Are you bragging about the length of your lens?
SLR, but that's no big deal. You're right.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, so I was there, and we were losing badly to the Braves. And I walked out there, and I'm taking pictures. And Diamond was on the mound, and all the pro photographers and everybody have left because the game was going so badly. There was nothing going on. And I watched Pinella walk out to the mound, talk to Diamond for a little bit, and then he's walking back, and I take this picture. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, it's really a great picture because he looks really concerned. And 2 minutes later, I hear the announcement over the thing. Lou Piniella has resigned from manager of the Chicago Cubs. He's going to go retire and all yada, yada, yada.
Wow.
So I actually have shot the very last
of the final walk to the
Lou
mound.
Piniella as a Cub. No, wow. On the way back.
On the way back.
That is
even
pretty
better.
Cool.
So I have been trying to find a way to get a hold of him. To have him autograph his picture.
How do you get, yeah, I mean, does Lou Piniella, I mean, you got
to
know.
I usually try
like
to pay attention to the sports conventions. Sometimes he's like a guest signer. You can keep an eye on that.
I wanted to document it that it's the very last picture taken of him as a Cub.
That's a great idea. I don't know how you do that. Maybe talk to the Cubs.
That's
got to
be through the Cubs, probably.
And I don't know if,
right.
But maybe Lou Piniella is, you know, I don't know. Maybe he's on Facebook. I don't know how to get a hold of Lou Piniella.
Yeah. No, I don't know how to get a hold of him. And the picture is on my phone because I've downloaded it there, but I've got it on my hard drives at home.
Okay.
And the look on his face is like walking back going, yeah, screw this. And
I'm out.
Show people this picture. You know, I shot a lot of pictures that day. I mean, I shot a lot, a cubby bear in there. And there was one picture I took of a couple girls and the cubby bear, and it took me 7 years to find out the girl's name, and I found her roommate somehow by accident. But it's just what I do. Anyway.
You might want to keep that to yourself.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
We'll
see. Persistence.
Going on about that. But I really want to know where I might be able to find Pinella, where I can sit down and just, like, I just got to find a way to do it so he can autograph this. And this is, like, the ultimate Cubs photograph. And
all right. I'll put you on hold, Doug. Right. I don't know. I know that we have great guests on the show, but I don't know how to get a hold of Lou Pinella. I'll bet. I think your idea of him being at a sports convention.
Yeah.
What do you think, Pete?
I have Mr. Pinella's phone number, and I was trying
really?
To because I was trying yeah. to get a hold of him for our Cubs coverage, and he has not replied to any message or text.
Hello.
So it could be one of those ones like I got a number from somebody. You know, it could have been 10 numbers ago. Yeah, so
that's great.
Number.
So yeah, so I don't know, Doug. I don't know what to do, but that's really good. Let's go to I think it's Kate Kateri. Is it Kateri?
Hi, yes, it's Kateri.
Kateri,
I'm a little
what
out
got?
Of breath. I'm walking my dog right now, so I'm a little out of breath. So I have a mint condition 1945 Cubs yearbook / World Series lineup.
Wow, 1945.
How freaking cool is that?
That's the coolest ever. How do you have it?
This is even crazier. So I was renting on the first floor of a 2-flat. I'm from the neighborhood, several generations. So I grew up, you know, by Wrigley Field, and I just turned 65. So Ernie was a part of my childhood, you know, from the time I was 2 till I was 20. So I was renting a first floor apartment, got married, husband moved in, clearly, and 2 years later, the landlord died, and they put the building on the market immediately, like the day of his funeral. The woman put it on the market. So we bought it, and I said, what about all your stuff in the basement? She said, I don't care what you do with it.
Wow.
Hello. It was in their stuff.
No way.
She said, just keep all that stuff. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Where do you have it now?
It's in my home.
Yeah. It's also
just,
it's in the basement.
I've never had it appraised. It's it's like hidden.
Okay.
But it's with all my Cubs stuff. The other cool thing I have, Ernie Banks Day, 1963. Back then, we would just wait for the players by their cars, you know, in the parking lot. It was a little different, right? And Ernie, my mom let us stay. I'm one of 7 kids. So we'd all go to the games. And she let my sister and I, Marilyn and I, stay and linger. And we were determined. And Ernie Banks came out like 3 hours after the game. Nobody was around. He was such a gentleman, and he signed our program.
Oh, that's great.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
That was cool.
Kateri, thanks
very
so
cool.
much. That was great. That's
that
good.
Was.
I like that. I like that a lot. 312-981-7200. There's got to be so many stories of, like, hanging out by the Danley chain link fence the tree. Over there by the Yum Yum Donuts, hoping that somebody comes back to their car. I remember that. That was what you did as a kid, right? You waited on the chain link until Sean Dunstan came through, or maybe like a Damon Berryhill. Damon!
I hear
Damon!
Ross is pretty personable.
Is he?
Yeah, he seems to be signing a lot and walking around the area.
I remember I did that maybe around the 89 season, and I remember the guys, it was a Berryhill would come by. There was a couple other guys, but the guy who got into his cool Mercedes was Andre Dawson. He didn't have time to come check it out. He just hit 3 home runs in the game. He had to get out of there.
Right. Incidentally, I looked up real quick. This might not be exactly what she has, but 1945 World Series programs are going for about $150.
Whoa, there you go. So
I don't know.
I'm not sure if it's you have to worry about hiding it.
Oh no,
necessarily for $150, but
I would definitely store it in a acid-free, you know, plastic, some kind of sleeve of some kind, not just paper bag or whatever.
All right, 312-981-7200. I got a ton of Cubs texts coming in, but let's shift gears, talk to David. You got sports stuff, David, but it's of a different sport.
I do. Hey, good evening. Great show
good
tonight,
evening.
Guys.
Hi,
really enjoying it.
Awesome.
Hey, so a few years back, we went to, my wife and I happened to be high school sweethearts, and we went back to a gala to support our high school, and there was a silent and live auction, and I happened to bid and win a football that is signed by Dick Buckets, Mike Singletary, And, why am I blanking all of a sudden? I'm on the radio. That's why.
It always happens, right? Welcome to my
world. And Urlacher.
Okay, right.
Oh, there you go. That's a good line, wow.
All three middle linebackers.
Right.
Great middle linebackers from the Bears. Some of the best middle linebackers.
Barry Minter didn't make the cut?
Right. Right.
And I really don't collect much sports memorabilia, but this was just something I had to have my hands on.
That's pretty cool, right?
That is pretty cool to have all three.
I sit in my office. It's fantastic. I love it.
See, yeah, I mean, you got displayed, right? That's cool. And, you know, that's not very common to get all three on there. But you did get it at a banquet. That's the only thing. Like, if you got it at the game, that'd be, like, the even cooler thing. But still, it's great that you got
all
that.
All right. David, thank you, buddy.
Hey, thanks so much. Have a great night.
Thank you.
All right. Let's get one more in. Let's get June in. June, what do you got, June? What do you want to brag about?
Well, I got a board game that came out in the 50s called Elsie.
Elsie, yeah. like E-L-S-I-E?
Yes, the cow.
Okay.
Oh, right.
And,
wow.
Yeah, and my daughter loves it so much. She had it framed and put under glass. You roll the dice, and if you get one of the, it's been a while since I played it, but if you get one of the characters, you move some similar to any,
Jumanji.
You know, game that you would follow a path, you know.
Right,
sure.
I thought you were going to say it's similar to Jumanji. It's a game in which you move two spaces and then there's an alternate reality.
Yeah, I looked it up here. It's about $15 to $25 in case you're wondering the value of it. But obviously, it seems like it's more a memory and a cherished
time. Yeah, more of a memory.
That's great.
I just wondered if you even heard of it, you know. Yeah,
well, I didn't hear about it, but I did look it up, so I know exactly what you're talking about now.
All right, thanks, June.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, June. All right, there we go. So 312-981-7200. I've got probably about 15 texts that have come in with Cubs memorabilia and Cubs stories. Let's continue on that thread. 312-981-7200. You got Cubs memorabilia. You got Cubs junk. You got Cubs stories. Oh, it's time to share those. 312-981-7200. Greg Flamm in studio with me. It's the Swap Meet. We'll take a quick break and an update on tonight's news. We'll be back. Stay with us. It's a swap meet here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Greg Flamm in studio with me, of course, at DuPage Pickard, Twitter and Facebook. We got a lot of great stuff tonight, and we sort of like themed it. The idea that it's Cubs themed, and the Download Nation has come through. Everybody wants to talk about it, so let's get right to it. Let's go to Michael. Michael, what do you got? What do you want to brag about, Michael?
Hey, Michael.
Okay, I've got a photograph. It's called The Yard of Our National Game. It's 36 inches long.
Wow.
We have it framed. It's about 18 to 20 inches high. And it's a picture that says World Champions 1908 Cubs. It's a picture of their ballpark taken from the outfield where the fans used to stand in the outfield because there wasn't an outfield wall. And surrounding the picture is an individual photograph of every player on the team. Tinker, Everest, Chance, every player on the team.
Wow.
And it was given, apparently, to workers in the front office of the team when they won the championship. It was given to me by 50-something years ago by a very good friend of mine who was a Sox fan. He bought it for $3 at a farm auction and told me that it would be 100 years from 1908 since the Cubs would win the pennant again, so I should see a picture of a winner.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
It's fairly valuable now, so a Cubs fan gets the last laugh.
There you go. That's what we like. The last.
That's a great
laugh.
Story.
That's good, Michael. Thank you for that. Right. That's amazing. That's a keeper, man. There you go. That's how you get it done. Michael's got it right. Let's go to Steve. Steve, what do you got, Steve?
Hi there. I have a a Topps Ron Sano Facebook card where it's got a game worn jersey swatch in it.
Okay.
And I used to be an usher at Wrigley Field for 3 years during high school. And Ron Sano's always been my favorite Cub. And well, listening to him, you know, call the games and all that kind of stuff. And had a chance to meet him a handful of times, but I was always working, so I couldn't, you know, ask for an autograph or anything like that. So the last game I went to, late August, early September, before Ronnie passed, something possessed me to bring this card with me. And it's, like, always been my treasured baseball card since I was a kid. And so I knew where he'd be, you know, looking for his golf cart from working there. And I'm some over there, I'm waiting, and while I'm waiting for Ronnie to come out of the dugout, there's an elderly couple. The woman's got, you know, an oxygen tank. They're easily in their, you know, their mid to late 80s. And Ronnie comes out of the dugout, and he's so concerned about this couple in his golf cart. You know, wanted to make sure they were okay to get to their seats. He's like, I can relate to the game. Don't worry about it. Take my cart. And was just so genuine all the time, but wanted to make sure that, you know, these fans could enjoy the game, get to their seats, and take care of them before,
yeah,
you know, even going like up to the broadcast. Yeah. And
yep, that's
yes, and then, you know, and then after that, you know, he saw the card unfolding. He's like, oh, what's that? Is, you know, is that me? Suppose you want an autograph. And we had a joke about it, and we talked for a couple of minutes, and he went on his way. And
wow.
Yeah,
that's great. Awesome.
A genuine guy and my most treasured possession.
Love it, dude.
That's great.
That's it, Steve. You nailed it. Nailed it. Good job, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
All right. There you go. Stories of Chicago Cub memorabilia, how you got the memorabilia, what you got, what you want to brag about. 312-981-7200. Let's go to the texts. I got a lot of texts. I got to scroll down.
Okay.
Let's do Cub stuff. 815 says, I have the 1969 Sports Illustrated cover with Fergie Jenkins as Cy Young winner, signed by Fergie.
Ooh, yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah.
That is good. As we were just talking about, this is the Sports Illustrated curse for the Cubs.
Right.
630 says, ceramic Cub uniformed Jim Beam bourbon decanter. About 18 inch tall. It's a bear with original box. Still has booze in it.
Wow. Yeah, offhand, I couldn't tell you, but yeah, that's a good one, though. Definitely hold on.
All right, 630 says, Playboy magazine with Cubs ball girl.
Yeah, I looked that up, and that's about $2.50.
It's actually depreciated over
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I guess.
That was a big deal, right? Who was that? Pete, wasn't her name again?
Marla Collins?
Yeah, Marla Collins. Harry loved her. Oh, there's a Marla.
Also, yeah. I've seen in the listing Gregory Hines was in that issue.
With, like a profile on him?
I guess, yeah. I saw it in the listing here.
It's like, Gregory bring Hines. A tap back. Gregory Hines
right.
talks about his role in Running Scared.
Right.
630 says, I have a Fergie Jenkins Hall of Fame 1991 signed baseball.
Yeah, those were $30 to $60. We looked those up.
Okay, and a plus a Bill Buckner signed ball. Did he also tell you?
Yeah, tie your shoes.
708 says, I have a Cubs doll that looks like the 1915 uniform. It's a boy about 20 inches tall. Feels like it's filled with a buckwheat type filling. It's definitely old. I just don't know how old.
Yeah, I
ooh, that's from Shannon, 708.
I'll check that on the break here.
I have an autographed book signed by all the 1969 Cubs.
Wow.
Is it worth anything? They didn't win anything, so I don't know what to
say.
I mean, even though it's a lore team, that team didn't make the playoffs.
Right.
So there has to be something in that to say the 69 Cubs, as exciting as they were, like from an actual, just from the vantage point of a collector, does the 69 Cubs resonate?
I Pete? Think it would. I don't
you
know
think so?
What Pete thinks.
I don't. I just always get irritated when I see a 1969, like hats that say 1969 on it, because I was like, you won nothing. You're known for a failure.
Right. Of all the things you
your,
can wear.
Your hat is a right. failure.
Of all the years you can wear, you know.
That hat, sir, is a failure.
A big fail.
All right. And 847 follows it up by saying, also a ball signed by Fergie Jenkins. Fergie Jenkins signed a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
847, I have a 2006 Medina PGA Championship golf ball signed by Ernie Banks. And a picture of him signing it.
Well, that helps certify it, but I don't think it'd be worth more than a baseball signed by him.
Yeah, right.
I would think the earlier Ernie Banks signed balls are worth more than his Hall of Fame because he, you know, they put HOF under his signature.
Oh, right.
And
right.
I think that's how you tell the difference.
312-981-7200. What's your story? What do you want to talk about when it comes to the Chicago Cubs, the memorabilia, the junk, the encounters? The encounters alone.
Right.
I feel like that's
the story.
That's the lifeblood of Chicago. A Chicago Cubs fan is which Cubs you've met.
Right.
And what happened when you met them. Greg Flam in studio at DuPage Pickard, both on Twitter and Facebook at Swap Meet. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. 312-981-7200. This is 720 WGN. It's a Swap Meet. The home stretch here with Greg Flam in studio at DuPage Picker on Twitter and Facebook. We are talking about, we're really just bragging about the stuff that we've accrued in our lives, but we also will evaluate some antiques, anything that you have tonight. Sort of a Cubs special with the Chicago Cubs. We get so much Chicago Cubs memorabilia that comes through on a regular swap meet.
Yep.
The idea of making it specific did not disappoint. 847 says, hey, I have a White Sox program. Signed by Sammy Sosa.
There you go.
So the question is, when he played on the White Sox?
I would guess, yeah.
That would be worth probably nothing.
Yeah, it might not be as much as a Cubs one.
Now, if you had like a late, bloated Baltimore Orioles Sammy Sosa, now we're talking. That's when Sammy Sosa was at his height. When he just come in the game just to hit a home run,
yep.
Strike out or hit a home run in a DH capacity. That's a Sammy I love.
I wonder if he still controlled the locker room with the boombox after in those days.
I wonder if he comes in for his 26 at-bats.
Yep.
And he's like, I need to set up this boombox. Let's go to Candy. Candy, what do you got, Candy? What do you want to brag about?
Hi, I have an LP that says Ernie Banks, The Theory of Hitting.
Wow.
It's an instructional record.
Wow. So that's actually like, here's how you hit a fastball.
Yeah, right. It's from 1972, the back says, and it has all his stats on the back of it.
Hmm. That's and an awesome idea, by the way.
Yeah, it shows him hitting with his bat and motions, you know.
Any doo-wop cool. on that record? No doo-wop on that LP?
No, you know, I never listened to it. I actually like to go to flea markets and stuff and bought it.
Yeah, I found a couple here for about $20, so that's... unless it's signed, that's about what you're looking at, I guess.
No, it's not signed yet. It's just cool.
I think it's cool.
It'd be cool if, like, if you weren't paying attention and, like, the B side, the last track was like, "Hit it!" I'm Ernie Banks, and I'm here to say, right?
That would be awesome.
That would be awesome. All right, Candy, thank you for that. That's a good one.
Thanks a lot. Bye bye.
Bye. That's a great one. That's actually
that's the type of stuff I would pick up.
Yeah. Right. All right. 312-981-7200. I'm fascinated by, you know, the concept that most of this stuff that we've got that called in today, most of it is related to the game. Right. But I would say I would be more interested in stuff that came in, like I've got, you know, we had the No Lights campaign, you know, the No Lights at Wrigley Field or the stuff around Wrigleyville. Mm-hmm. I think about, you know, like my dad grew up. And, you know, parking cars in 63 for the Bears championship, things like that.
Wow.
Like being able to sort of, you know, go back to that time and what it was like at that time. That's what I'd like to hear. 312-981-7200. I'd also say that my dad, I must be such a disappointment being a Sox fan because when he's such a diehard Cubs fan.
He's a Cubs fan? Okay.
That in 84, if you remember, for me, I would have been 10 years old. The Cubs, because they played day games, the first two games were day games. We were in school.
Right.
And so you'd come home, and I don't even think in 84 maybe we had a VCR, so maybe we were taping the games. But what my dad did is he set up this thing where he audio taped it off of WGN.
Okay.
Right? He audio taped the games and, like, got the fresh cassettes. And he put the cassettes, like, in an almost like a I don't even know what you'd call it, like almost like a trapper keeper.
Okay.
And, you know, because he put them all down so each one was meticulously, you know, game one,
labeled,
game two.
Yep.
And he recorded the actual AM radio broadcast of it on a cassette tape.
Wow. I used to do it with music, but not the Cubs.
Not the Cubs, not an actual call of a Cubs game.
Right.
But it was like,
this
was designed for posterity. This was, hey, this is something we're pulling out in 30 years.
That would be worth something.
Now, I guarantee we ruined it.
Right.
I guarantee my brother and I are like, hey, does this go backwards?
Yeah, and tape after 50 years.
I'm sure we ruined it. So.
Taping your rock and roll over it or something.
Right, exactly. I'm like, yeah, some raps we wanted to try out in the basement. How about this tape?
Put the Band-Aid over the tab that you punch out of the top of the cassette tape.
And if you remember, it was like designed. It was when Major League Baseball was like must have hated kids. Because the first right. two games were day games, and then the next two games were night games in San Diego that didn't start until 9 o'clock yeah. at night.
Right.
And so I remember I was with my grandparents for one of the game that Garvey hit the big home run. And I couldn't – we went to McDonald's and we were coming home and I couldn't stay awake and I fell asleep in the car. And I remember that my grandpa – you know, he's Graves, like such a Chicago guy, just kind of slaps you on the shoulder as a 10-year-old. Hey, time to go. Let's wake up. What happened? Garvey had a home run. They won. And I'm like, nice. Oh, no, that's it.
That's your memory there.
That's it. All right, let's go to Dino. Dino, you say you got a conspiracy story about the 84 Cubs.
Not a conspiracy. It was we're having dinner with four or five guys that I know from Union Hall, and one guy comes up. He says, Dino, give me – he said, you like to gamble a little bit, don't you? I says, yeah, what is it? He says, we're going to put a little package together. We're going to put $100,000 together. We get 40-1. I said, 40-1 doing what? He said, well – We're gonna bet against the Cubs that they will not win one in San Diego.
Oh
wow!
So the story ends with they each got 700,000 apiece.
What?
And 40-1, and they had to kick back 250 to the book.
Wow!
So that I didn't go. Obviously, I didn't give it to him. My wife didn't give it to him. I didn't go for it. And today I'm driving a cab.
There you go, Dino.
That's your story.
Thanks
right?
for that. Thanks well, for that story.
It's very sad. Thank you.
That is sad.
Thank
that
you
is
for
a
sharing
sad
that
story. That whole story is sad. And you know what? We were talking off air that the other story that never gets mentioned, especially when you talk about the San Francisco Giants and the Cubs of 1989. Cubs lost that series, Will Clark. But that World Series was the A's-Giants where the earthquake happened.
Right.
If you think about it, and I can't remember if it was Giants or A's who were home, but the Cubs could have been in that situation. The Cubs could have been in the earthquake. That could have been traumatic, long-term traumatic for the Cubs. It wouldn't have worked out either
way. That would have been part of the curse
right?
there.
Yeah, exactly.
The earthquake one.
So if you think about it in a way, we shouldn't be that upset about the 89 Cubs because they would have been involved in an earthquake and put themselves in harm's way.
Right. There
right?
you go.
Something to think about. I don't know.
That's awesome.
Does that work, Pete? I mean, does that help you with excising those demons?
Mm-hmm.
I always have a problem with who was the second starter behind Greg Maddux in the 89 Cubs. And I think it started, was it a Bilecki or a, something like that, like a B? He was
Mike Bilecki?
Yeah, Mike Bilecki, right?
Pitch with the Braves for a while.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. It was Maddux and Bilecki were the 89 Cubs, and then Mitch Williams came out of the pen. But those were the two starters, weren't they, of record?
I think Scott Sanderson was still on that team. I think, was Sutt still on that team? I think so.
Oh, yeah, the 3-4.
I think they, you know, suffered injuries, but I think those were the four.
Well, see. Hmm. Don't have to worry about that anymore. All right. You know what? This was great. The Cubs memorabilia was awesome. Greg Flamm, always a treat.
Always
a pleasure.
It is.
And when we come back, we'll have a couple of Thursdays off because we're going to be doing special post games for the Chicago Cubs games coming up here on the download. So we'll be back, I believe, a little bit later in October with Swap Meet. When we do, let's definitely turn it on when it comes to Cubs stuff.
We'll bring it on.
Greg Flamm is at DuPage Picker, both Twitter and Facebook. You going to be anywhere this week?
Probably I-80 in Tinley Park Flea Market, Sunday 7 to noon.
7 to noon.
And you'll see me around state sales and garage sales this weekend.
All right, Greg, great to see you, buddy.
Thank you.
Always fun talking Cubs history, Cubs memorabilia, Cubs junk. Always good. All right, that's going to do it for the download tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up next tomorrow night. Very excited. Mark Carmen will be here. We'll do a little pregame before the Cubs playoff game against the Giants at Wrigley Field. But then our week in review tomorrow night. I'm so excited about this. We have engineered a reunion. Walter Jacobson and Robin Robinson will be in studio doing week in review. The famed duo from Fox for so many years reunited and feels so good. Well, I don't know if it doesn't. I don't know yet. That'll be tomorrow. But very exciting.
Maybe for Walter.
For Walter, that's right.